Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we have a fun show, one that I'm looking forward to because it's a topic that touches everyone. It doesn't matter what walk of life you're in. It's all about how we as humans communicate with each other. I don't think it's the same. I mean, when we were younger, it was about face-to-face, being in the presence of somebody, sharing energy. And now everything seems to be more virtual, texting, and somehow you just don't get the same transfer of energy. And I think it's affecting our society as a whole, because people, so many misunderstandings and people with their feelings getting hurt, using language as a weapon, all these things I think have been highlighted or empowered by the fact that we no longer spend time with each other. So today I wanted to invite a special guest, Dr. Leah Cobb Snodgrass. She's a diplomat of the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology. She specializes in child, adolescent, and general adult psychiatry, and she serves as the associate professor and chair of behavioral health at Lincoln Memorial University's DeBusk College of Osteopathic Medicine in Tennessee. She graduated from the University of Kentucky College of Medicine and completed her internship residency in child and adult adolescent psychiatry fellowship at Emory University in Atlanta. Dr. Snodgrass is a native of Middlesboro, Kentucky. She is also clinically active in her hometown, seeing children, adolescents, and young adults. I wanted to also mention that she's a campus advisor for the Christian Medical and Dentistry Association and of the medical student chapter, and she's also taught group Bible study for medical and master students weekly for some time. So Dr. Snodgrass, I want to thank you so much for joining me, because I think it's nice to have somebody who specializes in human interaction with the mind, because I think that we're taking a lot of things for granted, and I would love to get your take on what's happening in our society.
Absolutely. So I think you mentioned something even prior to my introduction that's so true. We're basically moving quite far, the pendulum is swinging quite far away from that organic interaction that perhaps you and I are used to, or even older generations were used to. We're really moving away from face-to-face, in-person interaction where we can read nonverbal cues, where we can really, you know, see the expression on a person's face, or like you said, feel the energy that's in that interaction. And we're moving towards something that's much more one-dimensional in that it's basically screen to screen. So our young people are losing some of those soft skills that are so necessary to be a good and an effective communicator.
I think that's an excellent point. And to take that a little section or step forward, how important is interpersonal communication in our society? I think I know what the answer is, but I'm sure it's a broader brush that we need to actually think about.
Sure. So obviously the answer is that it is extremely important. When you think about it, it's via that type of communication that you build relationships. That can be personally or academically or professionally, but really that's all based on how you communicate. It's also through interpersonal communication that we find conflict resolution. So we prevent conflict by the way we communicate, or we de-escalate, and we can maintain peace through the way that we communicate. As a professor, as a teacher, it's also really powerful to give and to receive feedback through interpersonal communication. And to teach, in order to be an effective teacher, I have to find out ways of you know, giving my students what they need to be able to learn new and different information. And just socially, we are social animals. Evolutionarily, we've developed into social animals. There's certain things that we do and say and ways that we interact that indicate to other people, like, what is the vibe? What's the feeling in the room right now? That all comes from social context. I'm not going to talk to my patients in clinic the way I talk to my family hanging out around the dinner table. The social context has to be there. I also think that, collaboration and teamwork is all built on how well we communicate with one another. So these are just some of the ways in which interpersonal communication is incredibly important in our society.
Now, at the beginning of your statement, you talked about communication now being one-dimensional. Is that one of the reasons or one of the tools that's being used to divide us? Because to put it starkly, it's black or white, it's north or south, it's, all these divisions that are artificially imposed on us instead of the commonality of we all breathe, we all want the same thing, we all want to be loved and love somebody. But is this one-dimensional communication, does it strip our humanity? Does it make it easier for us to be manipulated based on emotion?
I think it does. I think, just think about how different it is to read what someone has said as opposed to physically sitting across the table from them, watching them speak it. Think about how different that is. And I think that's exactly what has happened. I can say something, but if I'm smiling and I'm indicating that it's kind of, I'm joking around, that comes across very different than if you just transcribe that statement without any emotional context. And that's I do believe that that is often used in that way to divide us. Absolutely.
And we didn't even talk about the insertion of AI and these artificial chatbots and all those other things that are in the system that nobody can seem to tease apart. But I wonder how much that's driving the narrative, driving the energy, literally enforcing this apartness that we feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, AI is now at least it's kind of still in its infancy, but it's already developed into what I think is a near adult person. So that's the way I just think developmentally. So even though we're just now hearing about it, obviously it's been around for quite some time and it's been being developed for quite some time. Mm-hmm. But absolutely, I can see how that AI is, moving us further in that one-dimensional direction and further away from that organic, emotional sort of social context of communication. By definition, artificial intelligence does not have emotion attached to it. Just by definition, because it's not human. So yeah, I can definitely see how that it's contributing to. I don't think it's part of the solution that we're talking about today.
I would absolutely have to agree with that. Now, when we talk about generations, and I think we're in the generation prior to all this AI and all this artificial removed from actually communicating, when we talk about our seniors and the interpersonal skills that they have, it's kind of a loaded question, but they have a power, don't they? They can let us know what it used to be like and actually interact with the younger generation who I don't know if they have a concept of it. Is there some power or should we pick their seniors' brains? Are they a way to try to work our way out of this?
Yeah, I think, it's quite obvious that if you're a baby boomer, which would be a little more senior than Gen X, I'm a Gen Xer, so I was born in 1970. So Gen X is born between 65 and 81, roughly, and baby boomers born between 47 and 64. If you think about it, those two generations, we are what are called digital immigrants, meaning we were not raised with smartphones, with the internet. Those things, for Gen Xers, at least those things came about later as we got older, but we were not raised with them. They were not available to us. No one, handed me a smartphone when I was, a year old and said, here, watch YouTube or watch a movie. That is not how it worked. And boomers the same. So those two generations are representative of those of us who desire that interaction. We want to talk to one another. We want to see one another. I like to go out to lunch and meet with my friends. I don't mind picking up the phone and physically calling someone and talking to them. I think sometimes it saves a lot of time. And sometimes I want the other person to hear the words that I'm saying and the way that I'm saying them. And that does not translate in text or email. So I think boomers and Gen Xers, we still have that ability to communicate verbally in a way that's so much more polished and appropriate than our digital natives. And so moving forward generationally, so millennials born between 82 and 96 and Gen Zs born between 97 and 2012, roughly, those are definitely digital natives, meaning they were born into a world where the internet was available and smartphones were readily available. Gen Zs were born, they're the iPhone generation. I mean, we had the smartest of smartphones by the time they were coming around. So those digital natives do not have the same social abilities and skill set that the older generations have. So yes, absolutely. I think there's a lot that they can learn from us. And on the flip side, there is an incredible amount that we can learn from them. I don't know how much you're around teenagers or younger kids, but my goodness, you can hand them any device. They don't have to look at a direction about anything. They intuitively figure it out and hand it back to you, and it's completely fixed. And I'm boggled. My mind is boggled because I'm still from the generation that has to read directions to do things like that. And they do not. They do not require it at all.
Now, when you think about that technical prowess, what about the emotional IQ? How good are they about subtleties and empathy and connectivity with humans? How are they in that regard?
You hate to over-typify. You hate to just speak in these broad generalities, but what I can speak to are medical students. Working in a medical school and teaching and training medical students, what I will say is that over the years, what we see is that they are much less socially skilled than perhaps their predecessors were. And I believe it gets just a little trickier every year. And even with the younger generations, I am the proud parent of two Gen Z daughters. They're twin daughters, so they're 17, so they're squarely right in smack dab in the middle of Gen Z. And their social skills are definitely delayed compared to the social skills that I had at their age. I don't know that they'll mind me saying this or not, but it's one of those things where they do not want interaction. They don't desire it. And they'll do everything in their power not to have it because they're kind of socially anxious. So we've almost moved away from it just being a lack of social skill and moved the pendulum towards it being more of a social anxiety. And so that's where I think that it really crosses over into something that seems almost pathologic. But the example I'll give, those of you who have been around teenagers have probably noticed that they'll sit next to one another and text one another instead of turning their faces towards each other and speaking. And I watch my daughters do that sometimes, and I call them out on it and say, look, this is ridiculous. You're sitting next to each other. Why are you texting each other and giggling and laughing? And they're like, well, because that's what we prefer. And again, it does not make that much sense to me, but they think of me as, the parent. You're just old fashioned mom. You just think that we always have to talk about our feelings and whatever. And so I'm like, no, I just feel like you need to practice communication because I promise it's going to be necessary in any field that you choose to go into. If you can't communicate, you're not going to succeed. So let's practice that. So that's what I see the trend moving towards. It's not just a lack of social skill, but it's developing into almost a social anxiety.
Now, I want to take our first break because I want to pick that thought up when we come back, because there's been a lot of literature, a lot of talk about how that anxiety is pervading the younger generation, depression, anxiety, and clinical ramifications of that. So let's take our first break and come back. Okay. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Leah Cobb Snodgrass. And before the break, you did a wonderful job of really explaining, because I see it too, and I don't understand it when I see people together, yet texting each other and having people sit around the dinner table, but everybody's on their device and not interacting, when that used to be the thing. You'd sit down and you'd speak with each other. Now, am I correct? Because I've been reading things about how anxiety and depression in the younger generations is becoming quite overt, and it's changing. I mean, the suicide rate, for example, has gone up. Do you think, I'm just curious, is there the fact that there's this social anxiety and this inability to express yourself, and then you have this outsized community where likes mean something and how many people follow you means something very removed that doesn't really give you value, but I think it's perceived as value. Is that, are they feeding on each other? Is this something that's an outgrowth of our inability or some folks' unwillingness to really engage?
I think so. I think what we see is that, you know, with regards to depression and anxiety, we have a hyper-connected group of young people who are probably more lonely and isolated than they've ever been, even though they're the most connected they've ever been. So what we see, of course, developmentally is tweens and teenagers, they have a developmental need for validation, for popularity, for connection. But through the avenues that they're seeking it, which is digital avenues, apps, social media, TikTok, etc., they're developing a sense of shame when they fall short of that social media worthy standard. So that's where I think we start seeing more depression, more anxiety, and very unfortunately, more suicidality.
Is there a difference in that mindset, the effective nature of this messaging between boys and girls?
There is. We see adolescent girls suffer quite a bit more with regards to depression and anxiety related to device usage, related specifically to social media. A couple of years ago, there was a study that was very specific to Instagram that showed that Instagram put adolescent girls at a higher risk of depression and suicidality. So we do see that that's by far the most vulnerable population are our tween and teenage girls.
That's amazing. That as adults, we have a bit of a frame of reference, but this, I guess nobody really speaks about, most of the social media stuff is completely fabricated. I watched a reality show where they were influencers that traveled the world and they were buying stuff and it was awesome. And it turned out it was completely staged. Like it was a toilet seat instead of a window for an airplane. I mean, if people knew this stuff, they would just laugh and just dismiss it. But how do we get them into, or jog them into, this is really too good to be true. This is not reality. And to be, you know, maybe we should start living our lives instead of through something. How do we get that message out there?
So I think you do that by example. And, you know, it usually falls back on the parent in some way. So it's important that we sit down with our children and figure out exactly what they are using their devices for, exactly how much time they are spending on YouTube versus gaming versus social media, which social media apps they're in. Are they primarily in Snapchat? Are they in Instagram? Very few of them are interested in Facebook. Facebook is for old people, but, you know, such is life. But at any rate, figuring out what they're doing, how much time they're spending, and then really delving into some things with them, like what you noticed, which is that things are staged. So, you know, the influencers, they take a lot of what we call, instead of selfies, they're called wealthies. Okay. So they'll put themselves on a yacht, or they'll put themselves somewhere really extravagant and fantastic, and they'll take pictures, and then they'll show everyone on their social media account how wealthy they are and how fabulous their life is. And that gives such a difficult sort of a view to our average everyday sort of kid, right? Because they're being raised in an environment that doesn't look like that, but they're being made to believe that, you know what, someday I too can be like that. Right now, if you were to ask the majority of my tween-aged patients, meaning those between 11 and 13, if you were to ask them what they want to do when they grow up, guess what the number one response is?
Influencer, maybe?
I want to be an influencer. I want to be a YouTuber. They'll just say YouTuber. And when you ask them, well, what are you going to do? Like, what would your area or your realm of influence be? They have no idea. They just want to do it. Again, it's not that they have some sort of plan. That's what they've been raised with, believing that, oh, okay, this is what I'm supposed to aspire to. Not a doctor, not a lawyer, not the president of the United States, not an astronaut, a YouTuber and influencer. So again, I think that it does fall back on us a little bit as parents to sit down with our children, to take a good inventory of what they're watching, looking at, and really talking to them about, okay, this is fantasy. Okay. This person does not even look like this in real life. Those are filters that have been put on, that has been brushed up and touched up and various other things. That's unrealistic. Okay. Here is a picture of someone who's more realistic. This is what they probably really look like at the end of the day. So you just have to kind of have those conversations with your kids and just remain aware of what your kids are seeing and what they're feeling based on what they're seeing. You know, it never hurts just to ask your kids, so how does that make you feel? Like when you see that picture or that person, what kind of feelings does that bring up in you? You know, why not? And another great question, parents, to ask your kids is, what is your relationship with your phone?
That's a good question. And from the standpoint of behavior, is there something that parents need to, I mean, obviously the child is on the phone 24/7, basically, but is there something in their behavior that is an underpinning or something that people, parents can look out for? I mean, teenagers are teenagers, so they're going to be... There's a lot of angst. There's a lot of things going on. But when should the parent become, you know, concerned?
Mm-hmm. I think whenever your teenager is, you know, not getting hardly any rest or sleep, because as we know, most teenagers use their phone overnight. Even when parents think that they've sort of, you know, sequestered the phones and the tablets and so on, you know, kids are very crafty. They figure out how to get up and sneak around and get them and take them right back to their bedrooms. So the vast majority of teenagers do use their phones overnight at the expense of their sleep. So what we're seeing is kids who are very tired and groggy and drowsy throughout the day, and then basically saving themselves and saving their energy so they can socialize and be online overnight. The other type of kid we see that's also interesting are kids who are so busy with school and after school activities that the only time they have to socialize and to connect and to hang out with their online community of friends or social media groups are the overnight hours. So we see two flavors there. But when your kid is not sleeping well, when your kids' grades start dropping somewhat because there's so much distraction going on with their phone, with their device, with their social media world of influence, those are times when you need to start thinking, okay, something is not quite right here. When a child gets to the point where they're so isolated that they don't really want to come out and hang out even with you as the family, let alone with other real people, other friends, other, you know, people that they may know through sports or church activities or whatever, if their preference is to sit in a room by themselves giggling at a phone, that's a problem. Because given the preference, they should always, I hope, choose to spend time with another physical human being as opposed to with a device. Again, let's take that one dimension of interaction and do our best to turn it into a three-dimensional interaction at least.
So I have a couple of questions, but I'm going to start off from the age of when children get introduced to these devices. Is there some sort of framework that parents can use, like no cell phones until age of X, or you have a cell phone and electronic free day? How do we start the process so they're not thrown in and then they have no frame of reference that they have? What do we need to do there? I guess my question is.
So, you know, there are some great resources out there that I highly, highly recommend. The average age of a child getting their first smartphone, their very own smartphone, is now 11. Okay, so that's the age at which most kids get their first smartphone. So that's your average age of first use on their own by themselves. That's quite young in my opinion, but that is about the average. But the resources that are available to us, there are some tools on the American Academy of Pediatrics page about social media that will kind of lead and guide and direct some of the discussion around it. But another, a report that literally came out today, so it makes our discussion so timely, is from Common Sense Media. And commonsensemedia.org, if you're not familiar with it, I highly recommend that you go online and check it out, because for parents who want to be informed about what their kids are watching, listening to, and playing, it is phenomenal. You can put any app, any video game, any movie, any television show in the search, and it will pull up exactly what content that child is going to be exposed to if they were to engage with that media. So it's a fantastic site. There is a membership fee, I think, but if you're an educator or a physician, it is free. Okay. And so commonsensemedia.org did this massive study and basically found out many different things that parents, I don't think, really knew about their teenagers and tweenagers' relationships with their phone. But the other thing that Common Sense Media has offered for quite some time now are family plans around digital use. You can go in and tailor a plan for your child based on their age, their stage of development, based on the media that they have access to. And you can actually go in and use some tried and true, these are evidence-based ways of managing social media. And you can kind of pick and choose the rules that work for you and your family, or you can create your own. But it at least gives you a template. It gives you a baseline to start at and then to build something that becomes more of a structured way of interacting with the digital media that your child has access to.
You know what I love about that is that it's parent-centered. Right mm-hmm. now, it seems like the child gets thrown into the out there school system with their buddies, and the parents don't have, they're like playing catch-up. Mm-hmm. So if you're doing this from the get-go, it seems like you have a template, a frame of reference, a foundation, and then the child is, it's just more controlled. It seems like everybody's got some skin in this game from what you described.
Absolutely. And I think as your child grows, your media plan will grow, right? You know, some things will become less important than others. Your child will start developing some literacy and some savvy when it comes to which sites are okay and which sites are not okay. You really have to be protective. The younger kids have to be very protected. Whereas as they get a little bit older, again, this is not going anywhere. Okay. Smartphones and digital media and social media, these are all things that are here to stay. They are never going anywhere. So we have to teach our children how to be mindful consumers of the information and the products that are out there, in the same way that we would teach them how to be, you know, really informed consumers when they go to buy their first car. We definitely need to be helping to inform them to consume all of these other things that are coming at them through their smartphones and through their tablets.
I think that's an excellent point. And that's also a good place to take our second break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. Again, we're speaking with Dr. Leah Cobb Snodgrass. And you've given parents a lot to think about and a lot of ammunition so that they can start the process of protecting their child and actually helping them socialize them, it sounds like. Is there, from the other side of this, is there so much a thing such as overscheduling your child, keeping them so busy that they don't have time for, you know, introspection, reflection? And just to disconnect.
Absolutely. You know, every child is different. And so there are kids who really thrive in that structured kind of, you know, from the time they get up in the morning until the time they go to bed, they know exactly what's on the calendar. They know exactly where they're going to be. And they thrive on that novelty. So they really enjoy, you know, an hour of music practice and an hour of this, and then I'm going to go over for 2 hours to this thing. Some kids really thrive on that. Others, not so much. So you do have to kind of play it by ear as a parent and determine what fits for your child. I have twin daughters, and one is very much, she likes to go, go, go. She wants every minute of every hour scheduled. It's just how she is. It's what she enjoys. The other one does not do well that way. She needs downtime. She needs some time to reflect, to slow down, to take a moment, to take a breath. So even with twins, I have two different ways of scheduling for them. So it's definitely different for each child, but there is something to be said for building in some time just of freedom and of relaxation. Okay. Mm-hmm. I think as parents, we often feel like we're not doing enough if we don't have them in every activity coming and going. But in reality, that is not the case. Many times I think our kids, you know, they would love to spend an hour just hanging out with us, as opposed to that same hour hanging out on the soccer field.
That's a really good point. Sometimes it seems some of the relationships, it's like the parent and the child are living parallel lives, right? They're not connected, and they kind of meet up, but it's not authentic. I remember as a child, we spent a lot of time. We had game nights, we'd play Monopoly, it was great. And that interaction, actually, it was the foundation. I knew I could always go and talk with my parents. I knew they always had time for me. From that one little kernel, and this to me, I think is very important for doctors, patients, everybody. It's that time that somebody feels that you're worthy and that you're important enough to take time out of their schedule. How does that affect a child? Is that really, I mean, parents are working, I understand they have to keep the bread on the table, etc. But it's a very subtle point. Does the child miss that ability to say, I'm just going to stop doing what I'm doing and I'm going to spend time with you because you're important? How does that play with a child?
I think it's incredibly powerful. And I think that, you know, so many of our children who don't have that one-on-one time or one-on-two time with both parents, I think that's one of the reasons that they're seeking validation through social media. And they're seeking validation in places that they really don't need to be in, because they don't believe that they're worthy of the time of their parents. And so I think as parents, as best we can, we absolutely need to take some downtime. You know, I'm not saying that every parent needs to do this, but in my home with my twin daughters, we did Sunday afternoon dates for years, because otherwise it was always the two of them were always together in the car. I was driving them somewhere or dropping them off somewhere. I never really engaged with them individually. So on Sunday afternoons, for most of their years from age 11 forward, we have done Sunday afternoon dates alternating every other week. So every other week, one of them and I go out together. We go to Starbucks or we go out to get a bite to eat or a dessert. And we just sit and talk about whatever they want to talk about. Sometimes I have a little bit of an agenda. I try not to. But other times it really is just for them to talk to me about anything that they would like to discuss. And, you know, I think that's been very healthy for them. I think they needed that. They needed that time alone with me as mom. And I felt very much compelled to give them that time, because otherwise it was always the three of us. And you can't really have those personal conversations when your sister is sitting right there listening to every word that's being said. So yes, for validation, the best way that parents can validate their children is to show them that they are worthy of the most valuable commodity that we all have. And that just happens to be time.
Now, I had a conversation today with a patient. It made me think about the parent and child relationship. And she said, you know, I want them to come to me. They can come to me anytime, but I'm not their friend. And what is that? How does that play again in the child's mind when you're not the parent, that you are a peer? Does that affect their ability to have boundaries or to actually feel safe in instances?
Absolutely. So I agree with the patient to whom you were speaking that yes, your role as parent is very different than your role as friend. So, you know, in my role as a parent, I'm there to lead, to guide, to direct, to train my child up in the way they should go, so that when they are older, they will not depart from it. Whereas if I'm just a friend, I'm not as invested in your trajectory. Right? Mm-hmm. I'm your friend, I'm your buddy, I'm your pal. I like to have fun with you. I like to hang out with you. But I'm not really going to answer to God for how I have interacted with you, unless it's been horrible, right? Whereas my children, I am going to stand before God someday and have to explain why I did what I did and why I did it the way I did it, right? Mm-hmm. So I believe that difference between being the parent, the authoritarian, the disciplinarian, the person who demands and commands respect, I think that is very different than just being the buddy, the pal, the person that, you know, oh, it's so fun. That's the fun mom. I never wanted to be the fun mom. I may be the fun mom just because I'm a fun person, but I don't want to be the mom that no one takes seriously.
I totally agree with that. That's the relationship I had with my mom. Now, that's the personal side. What about the school side? There's a lot. The role of the school has changed from when I was in grade school, high school. And it seems like the school has become the parent. They've superimposed themselves on the family dynamics, the family relationships, and the power between the child and the parent. How do parents take their power back in this situation?
Well, unfortunately, I think the schools have been put upon in some ways to assume the role of parents because so many parents have given up that role and have given up their ability. However, there are schools that have, like you said, that are kind of stepping on the toes of the parents, if you will, and going against some of the basic morals and ethics and values that family cherishes and holds to be true. And I think when that situation occurs, that is a big problem. So short of removing your child from that school and finding a different school, which frequently, especially in areas like where I live in a rural area, there's not that much to choose from. So if we have a problem with my child's school, it has to be addressed with the school because that's where they're going to go. So I think just keeping those lines of communication open, you know, become an advocate for the education that your child is getting. And if there's something that rubs you the wrong way, that is absolutely not ringing true for you and for your values, then talk to your school board, talk to your administration at the school that your child attends. Make sure that other parents are aware. You may or may not be surprised at how many parents have no clue what is going on during those 8 hours every day, Monday through Friday, that they are not with their children. You may be stunned at some of the things that are happening at your child's school that your child doesn't really talk about it and you don't know to bring it up. So it's really important that you have awareness and that once you are aware that you become an advocate for what you hold true and for your morals and your ethics. Again, every child in this country is entitled to a free and appropriate public education. And we have to be absolutely on the same page when it comes to what is and is not appropriate.
I think you're absolutely right. And you know, that anxiety that children are experiencing, there sometimes has to be a question asked by the parent. Is it being foisted or ginned up by what they're learning and their exposures and their interactions with the education system? I do recall when I was a kid, there was parent-teacher night. My parents were up there like soldiers every year. And we had, they give a report from every teacher. And what I always felt is that my parents were my advocates. No one was going to take advantage of me. Nobody was going to put me in a position that I wasn't able to succeed. And my parents were on point. And to me, that the child having that mindset of my parent is my superhero, the person who's always going to have my back, no matter what anybody else says, does that give the child more of an ability, if they're not comfortable with something, to say no, to speak with the parent?
Absolutely. And interestingly, another way in which digital media and device usage has changed that landscape, because like you, my parents would physically go to the school and we would have parent-teacher association or PTA meetings. They would also go for parent-teacher night. I remember those. I love those. My artwork was on the wall or my little sculpture or whatever, and everyone was oohing and aahing. That was awesome. But as you can imagine now, most communication between parents and teachers is done via text or via certain apps.
Oh, wow.
So the Band app is one that our kids' school uses. There's a few others that have been used, of course, and they're very good, but it's all about communicating with your kids' teachers through an app or through a text version of communication. So your child doesn't even see that interaction between you and their teacher. So they have no clue if you're aware, if you're unaware, because most of that communication is exclusive to the teacher and the parent. And very seldom, I believe, do we sit down and say, oh, did you know that your teacher texted me today that you're doing great in mm-hmm. this area of this class and so on and so forth. So yet another way in which having smartphones, having access to social media and apps has really changed the sort of face of the education that you and I receive versus the ones that our children are receiving.
Well, I feel that's a real disservice to children, honestly. So let's take our last break, because I want to go spiritual. I want to know, in your opinion, how God plays a role in this interaction. So let's take our last break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. You can read more about Dr. Snodgrass. You're on the CMDA website, correct?
Yes, I am.
And that's the Christian Medical Dental Association website. It's a wealth of information. And I think God is underpinning everything of what we do, and so important. As a Christian, it's easy for me to have that relationship. But has there been a change, do you think, in the importance of God in our society, in how we interact with each other? It just seems to be disconnected for some reason. Are you finding that? And if that's the case, how is it affecting how people generally interact?
I really do believe that in order to establish truly positive, healthy interactions, I think that a lot of that flows from the love that you have in your relationship with God. You know, years ago, I did a really interesting little, it was a personal devotional study called The Love Dare. I think a lot of people have probably done it. But it talked about how that your primary relationship is that unconditional love that you feel from God, and that comes to you. Again, the agape love of God comes to you. And then from that, it overflows into that first primary relationship, which is usually with your spouse. And then from there to your children, then from there to your family, your extended family, then your friends, then your acquaintances. And so as the fountain rolls down, it gets larger and wider with each tier. So I believe that healthy relationships are that way. I think that if you have the love of God in your heart, it's much easier for you to relate to those who maybe are unlikable, or who maybe are not the people you would choose to hang out with or go to dinner with. But guess what? They're still human. They're still created in the image of God, and they're still valued by God. And so as a result of that, you too have to value them. So I think that's the way in which I see God playing a role in interpersonal relationships. And as you can imagine, if God is not in the mix, if God is not a primary part of your way of relating to the people around you, then you are devalued, you are demoted, you are often cast off and mistreated. And so I think that's the primary way in which God manifests himself in healthy relationships versus the unhealthy ones, which often are without God.
I think that's a beautiful way to put it. And that makes me think about how powerful the word is and how powerful language is. And it's so negative. There's so much personal attacks, things that you can't change about yourself, who you are, what you are, as if there's some value placed on that, not what you do, but exactly your essence. And it's really hard to disconnect when you're seen or you see yourself as not worthy, or you're the enemy, or you cause some negativity in this world. It seems that it's being foisted from the language on people, but also from society at this point. And there's too many tribes or groups that are great together and they're against everybody. It seems like nobody's for something. They're just against things. Do you find that is that language or that energy is triggering some of the children and adults to be even more insulated?
I think so. I think that, you know, anytime that language is used for control and for manipulation, you're definitely going to see more isolation. People will, you know, circle the wagon, so to speak, and try to take care of themselves and the ones that they care about to protect them from the onslaught or from the attack. So we hear a lot now about gaslighting, and gaslighting is basically just a manipulation. It's a manipulation that manifests through psychological means, but it's a way of getting you to doubt your own reality or to doubt your power of reason. So, you know, you'll hear people say things like, everyone agrees with me. You're just really difficult. That's a great way of making you feel like you're isolated and alone. And it's this false alignment that the person assumes with a group. You'll hear people say, oh, I was just joking. And they'll say something really ugly or really mean-spirited. But then they try to justify it by saying, oh, I was just joking. So we do hear a lot about gaslighting and how that type of language is used to manipulate others and to control their behavior. But I think at the end of the day, the best thing that we can do, if we really want to have strong, positive, healthy interactions, we need to lean into the Word of God. And I think James was right when he said, we need to be quick to hear, slow to speak, and slow to anger. So, you know, quick to hear means actively listening. Listen to what the other person has to say, reflect it to them, let them say yes or no, you do understand what I'm trying to get across, and then recalibrate as necessary. Being slow to speak means that we think before we speak. We actually have our filter turned on, and we are thoughtful and mindful of what we say and what impact those words will have on the people to whom we're saying it. And then being slow to anger, don't let your emotions run away with you, and don't let your mouth just, you know, overwhelm other people with the emotion that's behind it. Being slow to anger means that you're in control of your emotions to the point that you don't weaponize them and use them against the people around you. I think that, again, you know, the word is full of fantastic examples of how to communicate. And if we would lean into that a little more as believers, I think we would set a much better example for those around us.
I agree. Doing the same thing, expecting a different result, or giving somebody the negative energy back just to deflect or maybe even protect yourself instead of just walking away or turning the cheek or just diffusing the situation would be quite helpful. Now, from the internet is very powerful, and it seems that people basically try to look up things that corroborate what they're thinking. Back again, when I was a student, it was about critical thinking. And it was about, you have a point, you have a counterpoint, and you have to look up whatever it is to prove your argument or disprove it. It doesn't seem that that is something that goes on anymore. It's, this is what I think, and I'm not going to listen to what you have to say. And I'm only going to go to places, sites, people that agree with me. How do we get people out of that? And maybe it's a comfort zone, but I think that's one of the things, again, that's driving our inability to change our behavior, our narrative, and to come back together as a society.
Well, I think, you know, we're always most comfortable with like-minded people. So in the same way that I am most comfortable with a group of believing Christians, you know, someone who is living some alternative lifestyle, they are most comfortable with a group of people who agree with their lifestyle. So I think we seek that comfort and we seek ways of supporting that comfort by finding things online that rationalize or reinforce whatever it is that we're doing. But I often see that people are not really digging into the evidence side of things. They're not digging into the realistic side of things. They're instead looking at, you know, we joke about Dr. Google and Dr. Wikipedia, but they really are just, you know, kind of glancing across the surface of what's available to them online or on apps or wherever they're getting their information, but they're not digging into it. And they're certainly not looking at the counterpoint that you pointed out. They're only seeking things that stroke their ego and make them feel better about their stance. And they're rejecting anything that does not do that. And I think that's where we have to be better. We have to be better examples to our children of how to actually have an appropriate debate over a topic, how to look up the resources, how to figure out what the point is versus the counterpoint, and how to support the opposite argument. I don't think very many of us do any of that. We just assume and expect that the schools are doing it. And let me tell you for sure, they probably are not, with very few exceptions. So again, at least in my line of work and in my purview, it often goes back to parenting and setting that example for your children and helping them to determine what are the appropriate resources online and which ones are just out there to cause confusion and division. But just being that constant presence, looking over their shoulder and helping guide them through this world of information that is really there to engulf them, if not for the parent pulling them out of the abyss.
The parents have so much power, and with God's help and under the guidance of God, I think we could fight this and we could win this battle.
Absolutely.
You know, time goes so quickly. I very much enjoyed our conversation. How can people reach you? I know that you are working with medical students, so I don't know, do you have a website? Do you have a blog? Anything that people can reach you if you so choose?
Sure. Well, I am one of those old people that is on Facebook. So if anyone wanted to see me, it's my full name. But if you put in Leah Cobb Snodgrass, I really think I'm about the only one that has that particular two names squished together at the end. But you can find me, and I live in Northeast Tennessee. So you can put in my name and Tennessee, and it should pull me right up. Feel free to send me any message or question. I don't check it religiously. I'm not a slave to my phone or to my social media, but I do check it occasionally, and I'll certainly get back to you if you send me a question or a comment.
Well, Dr. Snodgrass, I really appreciate your time. It's a wonderful conversation. I think it gives parents some insight. And I mean, if you're feeling powerless, you're absolutely not. You were very eloquent at stating that.
Absolutely. I appreciate the time. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I look forward to hearing from all of your listeners.
Well, thank you. And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk Events.